Hi, and welcome to More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it. I'm Amanda Nystrom, the Chief Operating Officer at Command Prompt, a leader in open source excellence since 1997. We hope that you enjoy the podcast today and contact us for your Postgres and full stack needs, including 24/7 support. Find us at 503-667-4564 at commandprompt.com or at sales@commandprompt.com. Enjoy.
Welcome to More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it. Today, we are meeting with Mark Porter again, CTO of MongoDB, and our theme is engineering culture. Mark, give us a brief introduction.
Hey, everybody. JD, it's great to be here again. Thanks for inviting me back. I've been doing databases for about 35 years. I'm a complete tech geek. You can find me at Mark Loves Tech on Twitter. And I'm currently the CTO of MongoDB, and it's been a great career to get here. But I'm not here to talk about my career today. I'm here to talk about all the engineering orgs I've seen and kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I'm hoping we can have a really fun talk about that.
Yeah, I agree. It came up on our last episode, and for those who are listening now new, you can find us on all your major outlets under More Than a Refresh. Mark has a wealth of knowledge, has been in this career for 30 years of managing engineering cultures. And Mark and I came about together because one of my projects is people Postgres data. And that's kind of a term that we coined for Postgres conference. And the point was, is to remind, frankly, engineers, a lot of engineers, that were people first, because engineers in our experience, and as someone who's highly technical myself, have a tendency to drill down on a particular technical problem and forget that there are people around us. This particular podcast is non-technical. And, Mark, what is some of the good, the bad, and the ugly in terms of engineering culture? What are your thoughts there?
Well, one thing that's kind of fun about this podcast is that though you and I may be on the other side of the rows and tables versus documents divide, we are not on opposite sides of the great engineering cultures divide. And we are on the same side. And the good, the bad, and the ugly basically comes down to good engineering culture is not dependent on company size. It's not dependent on what industry you're in. Those things can certainly have an effect, but what it is dependent on, in my opinion, is intentional leadership. And so when you think about company size, as an example, that's one dimension where, you know, you need to not think that just because a company is 10,000 people that has a bad culture. There's also things that can specifically make a culture bad or specifically make a culture good.
Okay, well, that's interesting that you bring up company size, because when I, you know, we've got our notes, you know, we've obviously prepared for this podcast a little bit. And when I read the company size doesn't determine the culture, I kind of disagreed. And I get where you're coming from with, like, just because you have 10,000 people doesn't mean your company has a bad culture. In fact, I would actually agree with that 100%. And I think that larger companies get a bad rap for their success. But from a company size perspective, I know that, you know, Command Prompt, for example, you know, we've been around since 97. We were a very small company for a long time. And that it did affect our culture, right? There are certain things that always applied. Like, we always wanted to do a good job and we always wanted to be honest and transparent. And we didn't like to play some of the games that some companies like to play with their customers. But on the flip side of that, you know, when you're a small company, it's feast or famine sometimes. And that will adapt your culture, you know, on what you're willing to accept and your threshold for pain, I guess. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, the feast and famine thing is interesting because it comes down to urgency. And I think that one of the areas where large companies often do lose their way is they lose a sense of urgency. Now, it might not be about making payroll next month. That's one kind of urgency. But it should still be about delighting customers or getting that next unbelievable release out or whatever it is. So I think a sense of urgency is key, because there's only 24 hours in everyone's day. And a sense of urgency is absolutely essential to us prioritizing what we do. So that's one thing, is that sense of urgency, which I think you gotta keep even in a large company. The second thing I think is, I know command prompt is what, like, how big is command prompt?
We're about 20 people.
Okay. So when you start, all of the authority sits with you, and then you hire some people and some accountability starts sitting with other people. And then as you get bigger, you know, the authority stays with you and the accountability may move out to a second level of leaders. What you need to do is you need to move authority down in the organization along with accountability. So one thing that I always do is I focus very hard on making sure that authority and accountability are in the same place in organization. And if you do that, it doesn't really matter if it's a 15,000 person engineering organization or a 15 person engineering organization.
Interesting. So your point about pushing authority and accountability down, I've run into this. We've seen this with many companies that, you know, almost all of our customers are larger than command prompt. And that's because of how specialty we are. But we do see scenarios where, you know, you have authority, say a CTO, no offense, Mark.
Yeah, you got to watch out for those CTOs.
Yeah. My favorite, you know, the CTO that thinks he's still a developer, right? And the problem that you run into is that they have the authority, but then they don't have the accountability, and it ends up putting, I think, an undue pressure on the engineering team. But I want to come back to this sense of urgency that you said. And this is curious to me, because this is something that command prompt struggles with, having a sense of urgency, because of we are profitable, we are stable. And since we're a services firm, our sense of urgency is derived from the client's sense of urgency. And a lot of times our clients are looking to us as partners to actually temper their sense of urgency, because it's very easy to say, we must get this done now. And then what happens is that everybody must get this done now, which negates the urgency, right? Because you can't get it all done now. When you got 10,000 people, actually, how many people does MongoDB have?
You know, I think we're saying in our earnings announcements, we're around 3,000 people these days.
Okay, so 3,000 people, which means you're successful, largely profitable. You've got 401k, you've got, you know, health insurance, you got all the goodies. And from our last podcast that we shared, it seemed like you had a very, very good culture going on. But how do you create a sense of urgency out of a working product, right? I mean, you have an existing working production class product and service. How do you continue to inspire a team? Is this through leadership? Is this through management? But how do you continue that sense of urgency without having it lead to burnout?
So I do it by connecting two things to every engineer. And this is just an engineering point of view. I connect pride in the quality of the work they produce to them and give them the enablement to have pride. And so when something's broken, there's urgency around the pride. And then I connect them to the customer. And like you say, customers do have a sense of urgency. They want everything done today. And when you put those things in balance, you get an engineering team which knows how to be urgent about producing high quality software for their customers. And so, of course, it takes maintenance and time. But if you just go too far down the pride level and you get this ivory tower engineering team, there's no sense of urgency there. And if you just go down the customer requirements, I mean, customers are an insatiable beast that will eat everything your engineering team can put out, and you will indeed get burnout. So you have to kind of balance those.
That's a good point. You said pride, and that can be very much be a negative as well. One of the things that I like to educate our team on is don't be prideful, be proud of.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And you know, I think the reasons are obvious. You know, when you're prideful, you start getting into some of the problems that are bad in engineering teams, which we will get there. But just as a note, and one of them is being territorial. Mm-hmm. But you know, when we outline the good of engineering teams, you know, in terms of culture and you know how to keep people positive with a sense of urgency, how do we deal with the fear of making a mistake, especially with, you know, as you get more mature in your career, you're less worried about making mistakes, but as you hire new people or people that are new to the company, not even necessarily, you know, say newbies, you know, there's this great fear of either letting down your boss or letting down your supervisor or letting down the client, which is even worse. How do we process that in a productive and constructive way?
So I got to tell you, this is an area I'm still working on right now, but here's my thoughts. This has been an area of thought for me over the last 6 months. I think it requires changing the goalposts. So if the goalposts are doing the right thing and the goalposts are innovation, then you can say that experimentation, and this is something I've been thinking about lately. I mean, none of my teams are going to tell me they plan to fail next quarter. Let's be really clear. But my team should be allowed to tell me they plan to experiment with two different approaches. Now, by definition, one or more of those approaches is going to fail. So when we talk about failure, I don't tell any of my teams to fail. I don't think anyone is brave enough to propose failure as a goal. Instead, what we try to get them to do is propose innovation and experimentation. And by definition, if your team says they're going to try two things this quarter, then one, or maybe both of them, is going to fail. And that's okay. So that can remove the fear, because when you endorse the plan that they're going to try two things, you've endorsed some degree of failure. You've also endorsed success. So that's one thing. Learning from mistakes, learning from experiments, constructive feedback loops are really, really important. And so the other thing you have to avoid, though, is you have to make sure that everyone is pushing at the right thing. And so things to avoid are avoid vanity metrics, like the number of devs who visited the web page. That is a terrible vanity metric, because let's say that you could pay people to visit the web page, or let's say those developers are having a terrible experience on the web page. So you have to go one level deeper to avoid these vanity metrics. And you have to get your team bought into those vanity metrics, got bought into real metrics, not vanity metrics. And so, you know, that's a really important thing to do, because if the metrics that you're using are the wrong metrics, nothing else can ever work. And I think that's really important as a leader to stay away from that, because frankly, the vanity metrics are the easiest ones to measure.
No, I agree. And they're just popcorn, right? They don't really matter. But going back before, when we were talking about learning from your mistakes, you know, I think it's important to remember that everybody fails. It's what you make of the failure, right? Nobody's perfect in this world. I think there was once one metric that said that, you know, most entrepreneurs, you know, close or fail in five businesses before they find success. But one of the issues with failure, this is something I struggle with all the time, which is if it isn't broke, don't fix it. But in reality, just because it's not broke doesn't mean it can't be improved. And if you're not improving it, then isn't that in itself somewhat broken? And when I ask this question, I'm actually leaning into the human part of this, not the technical part of this, in terms of professional growth, being a better person, you know, moving forward as a human, moving in a positive direction as a human. I think it's very easy, especially for technical people, to kind of get in their own box and be afraid, maybe not consciously afraid, but, you know, why would I do this different? This has been working for 15 years. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really important. The human, I love that you're bringing the human element into it. So, you know, often on these podcasts, I get asked, if you could go back and talk to yourself at 25, what would you tell yourself? And what I would tell myself is focus on the human element, focus on being a good communicator and a good listener. A lot of technical people don't focus on that, even though we all have the same skills as other people once we decide to exercise them. My wife might differ, but after 20 years of marriage, I think I'm a better communicator. And so I have this little thing I use called these cultural hints. And they're things like how to communicate with each other, like listen to the other person, anticipate what they're trying to say, analyze what they're trying to say, and answer the unspoken question. Another one, believe that the people you're working with are brilliant and well-intentioned, because if they're not, no conversation is going to go well. You know, believe that you're going to work together to build mechanisms to make the place this constant improvement. And all of these are things where humans work together. And I think that I have a bunch of these, but I think that if you work on those things of being a better human, then everything just gets easier on the technical side. It's like having the right foundation for your building as opposed to a shaky foundation. If you focus on being a better human, then you can build better tech. If you don't, then everything you build and your teams all feel shaky.
You know, that's a great point. And, you know, as someone who's been in the open source / free software community since, oh, goodness gracious, 91 or 92, really long time. This is something that has recently been coming around past 5-ish years or so, where a new generation of open source contributors are demanding the humanity. And I think that the communities, all of them and globally, are benefiting from it, but it's also creating a rift between other, you know, the older generations and the newer generations, because the older generations are, a lot of them, not all of them, of course, but a lot of them are basically, get over yourself. We're trying to build some software here. And if you look into what's going on in the Perl community right now, is a really good example of that problem. And I've seen it in other communities as well. And that kind of leads towards professional development, professional growth, right? At Command Prompt, one of the things that we do is, you know, most companies have some kind of compensation review, right? Every year, where you go through and it's a performance review, and you might get a cost of living increase. And then if you've done over and above, you get, you know, an extra amount that you wouldn't normally get, something like that. Well, one of the things that Command Prompt implemented just this year was in an effort to encourage professional development, not just technical professional development, but human professional development, is that we enabled our team to receive performance increases quarterly or bi-yearly based on professional development goals that they met in that time period. And the idea being that you don't have to wait. And it wasn't always, you know, say, sometimes it was time off. Right? If you achieve this goal, you get, without it affecting your PTO, we'll just give you some time off or something like that. But the idea being that you could reap the rewards quarterly or bi-yearly versus having to wait a whole year in hopes that you actually reaped the reward. And it kind of gave them an incentive. And some of the things that we've done, of course, you know, we've done your standard stuff like, hey, we need you to get Kubernetes certified or something like that. But we also did things like, we want you to take this edX Harvard leadership class or this business communications course, because we want our entire team to be better humans, better communicators, be able to build those relationships, to be better people, which enables them to be better servicers of the client as well. And of course, we hope it helps them in their personal lives. What kind of professional development does MongoDB encourage beyond, you know, the obvious staying up with tech?
Yeah, I mean, I love that you guys do that. I think that there's kind of being a better human, and that stuff can sometimes come across as a little fuzzy if not presented well. And I think it's important, but it's hard to say, you know, being a better human and being a better listener. I mean, a lot of tech people are going to go, oh my God, really? You're not going to send me to a class to be a better listener. But what you can do is you can send them to a class, like you said, like a Harvard business class or a Harvard executive management class, where all of a sudden they realize that being a better listener is required to do well in the class. So at MongoDB, we have a set of things where we have management courses, leadership courses. Notice those are different things. Management is about, you know, how I take care of you and your salary and your performance review, and leadership is about inspiration and freedom and candor and empowerment. And we have classes in those areas and we encourage people to take them. We don't actually have them on people's reviews yet. And I'm actually pondering that. I think I might come back to you in a week or two with some thoughts on that. I like that. I wrote that down when you were saying it. We also, of course, have the tech classes. And we also, of course, have, you know, all the classes on just, you know, like all the stuff you need to do to be a member of the community, of the MongoDB community as an employee. So we have all those things, but we don't actually fold them into our review process or rewards process quite the way you did. I think that's innovative.
Well, thank you. All right. So we did briefly touch on vanity metrics, and I think that anyone in the know, and especially engineering teams, quite honestly, know that, you know, how many times a page has been hit isn't really that relevant, because like you said, $1,000 you can have someone build a robot from a bunch of different IP addresses and hit the heck out of the website or the app or whatever. It's not relevant. But there's other bad things that can happen in, you know, negative engineer, well, in really any culture, but in this particular instance, we're talking about engineering cultures, and, you know, ass covering in politics or being territorial. You would think that it's obvious, but a lot of people go to work with a mindset that I need to CYA in order to succeed, cover your ass in order to succeed. What are your thoughts? How do we grow people beyond that? How do we create a culture that makes that better?
Well, I think the first part about it, and it is a real problem, and I've worked at companies and groups where that was certainly the case. I think the first thing to do is remove the reasons that it's created in the first place. So, one thing, for example, is I once worked at a company that said, I don't want people working together, because then when promotion time comes around, how will I know which of the three of you to promote? And it's like, really, you're kidding me. So they actually had a company culture which advised engineers not to help each other out. And that just blew me away.
That's terrible.
Yeah, it's just terrible. And that actually exists. And I'm not going to name the company. And but it's actually written down in their employee guide. And so I think you should encourage people to work together. I think you should tell people, hey, if the three of you all do really well, we'll give all of you different rewards that are appropriate. The other thing I think that's important is to stomp out all signs of territorialism immediately. And territorialism, look, I believe that bullies are most often the most insecure people in the room. And I believe that people who are territorial are often the most insecure people in the room as well. They're not the boldest people. They're not the most secure people. And so you have to figure out why these people are being territorial. Maybe they don't want anyone else in their code because, heck, they don't actually understand their code. Or maybe they don't want anyone else in their code because, you know, they don't understand the rest of the code and they don't want to work on anything else. And they think if other people work on their code. And so, and this is not a great answer for this podcast, but when I see territorial behavior, it almost always requires getting to know that person at a deeply personal level to figure out what's going on. There's no recipe. And that's what a leader or a manager does, is they go, wow, you seemed really uncomfortable in that meeting. Can we tease apart what was going on there? So I'm sorry, there's nothing magic there. The second thing you can do is you can set examples. And so leaders need to set examples of leaving their egos at the door. When someone challenges a leader, the leader should actually be vulnerable to the challenge and say, wow, it's interesting you think that. Are you saying that maybe we're doing the wrong thing on this team? And just be vulnerable. And instead of a leader coming to a meeting feeling like everyone has to walk out saying, wow, that leader is amazing, I think what they need to walk out is, wow, that leader actually cares about all of us. And that is a completely different goal. And if you walk out with everyone feeling like that leader cares about us, territorialism has a chance to dissolve. Notice I didn't say it dissolves. I just said it has a chance to dissolve.
Well, I think that it's human nature to want to hold on to something that you built, right? I know that I've suffered from territorialism in the past. In fact, my life, and this is absolutely true, has gotten so much better since I learned two things. One, I am not a manager, period. It's not, at our previous podcast, you mentioned something to the effect of you need to care about someone's cat. I don't. It doesn't mean that I don't, I just don't. It doesn't mean that I don't, you know, appreciate that your cat is sick or whatever, but my brain, my thought process is working on a different level, not a better level, a different level. Just because I'm a leader and not a manager doesn't make me a bad leader. It makes me a bad manager because that's not my skill set. So learning to let go of that and allow someone who is a manager to be a manager has greatly driven the recent success of Command Prompt. So there's that. And I think that if everyone does that, it becomes a lot easier. But further, one of the things that I've learned is what's the worst that can happen? If I walk into a room and I got six people and they all want to question the vision I've set forth, the worst that can happen, if I let go of my ego, the worst that can happen is I can learn and have a better vision.
I agree completely. I also find, frankly, that when I'm doing succession planning and trying to find future leaders, and future managers, the problem is if the current leadership staff is actually really good and actually runs meetings and decides roadmaps and does all this, you get this gap over time where they get better. And the people who report to them, you would think would get better just by example. And that does happen. But, you know, it's one thing to see and it's another to do. And they're like a factor of 10 apart. And so what you'll see often happening is you'll see organizations where there is no succession planning. And the leader who's in place is just awesome. And anyone who might be a candidate is so much less awesome, there's no succession plan. And so I find that when you step back, you will often be deeply surprised by how people step into the void.
No, I agree. When people are allowed the opportunity, you know, we've discovered this with our team, and there's been a few that haven't stepped up. It's just not in their makeup. But allowed the opportunity, many will step up and surprise you. You think to yourself, you know, when you say no succession planning, part of that's territorial, right? Is that if a lot of people try to make themselves invaluable to the company so that they can't be replaced. But that's a remarkably selfish perspective, because guess what? You could step out the door, fall off your steps, and you're dead. And you've just left this entire company that is employing hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of families so that they can eat and live and provide for their children. You've just left them in a situation where they may not, or at least not easily, recover from. And it's important that that territorialism, regardless of code, if you get territorial about your position and who you are and your you know, reputation or whatever, it's not about, it no longer becomes about doing the right thing or the good thing. It becomes about yourself. And when it becomes about yourself, you're not able to build people. You can't build people if you're focused on yourself.
Yeah, that's true. By the way, some territorialism comes from a good place. Like, I really care about the company. I want to make sure we do stuff. I'm not sure you're ready. But yeah, that's interesting. So
yeah, no, I agree with you. Don't get me wrong. I mean, but wouldn't that fall under like accountability or responsibility?
Not necessarily. Yeah, so I've been working, and there will be a paper coming out on this that I've been working on, which is modeled on a lot of stuff I've read in the industry. And so it won't be my work. It'll be the work of me collating a lot of things. If you learn to speak candidly and low stakes at a company, And that means that everyone just kind of says what they feel, obviously without being insulting or whatever, but they just say what they feel in a productive way. Then that sets a base. And then on top of that, if the management and leadership feels like they can give people context, i.e. this is why we think this is important. And then of course, listen when the staff comes back and says we're wrong or here's a tune-up on that. So if you think about candor and then context, and then what happens is you say, well, now that you have the context, I'd like you to solve this problem. Because by the way, I'm a leader and I have 7 groups that report to me. And I think you're group 3 and you need to solve this problem. I've given you all, candidly given you all the context. So now you're empowered and you can experiment. We talked about that a little bit earlier. You're empowered to experiment and you're safe. You're safe with the fact that you know everything you need to know. I'm not hiding information from you. And I'm not going to punish you when you try 3 things and only one of them works. So that's it. And what I've found is accountability, which is what all leaders want and all managers demand, is they want all of their employees to take accountability, remember? And because they want them to be like, hey, I told you to do this, you did it. Even bad managers want accountability. Good managers want accountability. What I've found over the last 2 years is accountability just starts seeping out of people's cores. They start taking on accountability. Now, when you aren't candid with them and it's political and you don't give them context and you don't empower them and you don't make them feel safe, all you get is hiding and blaming and territorialism. So to me, that's the recipe that I'm currently working on in my head. And I'm kind of passing every week of my job through that 5-step process. And I'm seeing how it's going. What do you think about it?
Well, I think you're right that empowering your people to succeed, you know, which is basically what we're boiling this down to, is a way for them to either step up or not. And those that step up, you're going to find your leaders, your managers, your senior engineers, and they are hopefully going to produce a positive result. Now, interestingly though, let's talk a minute about what does it take to get there? Because, you know, everyone has legions of bad stories of teams that they've worked with, but how do we preempt the bad? Right? I mean, it starts at the interview, right?
Yeah, I think this is particularly relevant in light of the great resignation that's going on right now. As everyone is looking at their lives and they're saying, am I in the right place? And during COVID, I mean, I don't really know exactly what's going on there. Frankly, to tell you the truth, I think it's either the great hiring or the great inspiration. If you're at a good company, then it's the great hiring. And then it's the great inspiration because people are now standing up for themselves. So that's part of it. But that's kind of a side note. And I realize I went off on a tangent there. I think when you interview people, it's about chemistry and it's about, do these people, you know, get along together? It's not about nitpicking syntax errors on a whiteboard. It's far more about, is this a good human being who you want at your company, who also has the good technical skills? And I think that's what really isn't probably focused on enough at the interview, is this a good human being?
Okay, now that's actually a very good point. Now you said, you know, chemistry. Now chemistry is a pretty well-known thing, the human chemistry, whether or not you click and things like that. But one of the strengths that we found at Command Prompt is, one, yes, are you a good human? But what defines that? And the reason I ask is because we have found through the years that an eclectic team is by far the most productive. And when I say eclectic, we have atheists, we have agnostics, we have Christians, we have Catholics, we have, I think we even have a Buddhist, we have some who are just searching, right? And speaking of which, what you said, if there was something I could tell myself back when I was 25, what would it be? For me, it would have been listen to your voice in your head, because I was cutting a dormer on a second story window. And in my head, I kid you not, I heard a voice twice that said, you're going to fall. And I said, no, I'm not. Both times I ended up falling. And now I need literally an artificial ankle. They want to replace my ankle.
Wow.
So you know, listening, being able to go back when you're 25. But my point there was, what defines a good human? And to me, a good human, number one, cares about other humans. And number two, and this is a hard one, but it's, it can see the bigger picture.
Yeah, I think there? That comes, I think that, wow, this is interesting. I mean, you made it really big with the voice in your head thing. I think what's really interesting here is, and this might come off not great, but I'm going to go there anyway, which is rational human beings are absolutely necessary. And so people who know how to think, now they might not think like you think, to your point, but they have a mechanism of getting to a point of view. And that, to me, if you get someone in an organization, and the more senior you go, the more the blast radius is, you have to have people who know how to come to a point of view. That may be they write things down. That may be they go stare at a sunset. That may be they vociferously debate in a conference room at a whiteboard. And I think that's important because as leaders, certainly, our job is to make decisions every day. And so when you talk about, you know, the best way to preempt the bad starts at the interview, finding good, well-intentioned human beings who know how to do critical thinking is so important. And yet we're so tempted to say, ha, this person knows about distributed data structures and knows about databases. And oh my God, look what they did on Linux. And you may or may not have a good human being who knows how to critically arrive at decisions there.
That's, you've kind of thrown me there a bit. You're right. You may not have a good human being. And in our market, in our culture, there's a lot of not good human beings that are, I don't want to say idolized. I think that's the wrong term, but let's say looked up to, fan followed, right? And with the shift in the culture, we're seeing a lot more, I don't even know how to put it. It seems to me that in the tech industry, there's been a critical juncture in the past few years where, as you said, being a good human is now a requirement. Whereas before, it was just be a good engineer. And being a good engineer is not good enough because you're limiting the scope of your ability to succeed as a person by being just a good engineer.
Yeah.
Okay, so continuing forward, and this is fantastic. And you know, when we set this up, you know, you and I both said, well, now that we have 4 hours of things to talk about, but we don't have 4 hours today. But I do want to talk about healthy companies, you know, healthy company, healthy culture, healthy people. And we talked about being a good human. But there's something outside of the company that it becomes integrated if done properly, right? And I used to read about Japanese cultures, and there's certainly good and bad everywhere. But one of the things that some Japanese companies do is they have like company-wide calisthenics in the morning. And as Americans, and I'm not suggesting that companies do this, I frankly don't have an opinion on that part. But what I do have an opinion on is the fact that the company drives a mission of self-care. Can you talk to that a little bit, Mark?
Yeah, I think there's so many dimensions of self-care. So again, if I'd been able to go back to myself when I was in my 20s, I would have said, figure out how to de-stress yourself. I would have said, figure out how to know what's important to you. I would have said these things, which I think I was ignoring at that time because I was just trying to crank out code. And that's what I was rewarded for, was cranking out code or fixing bugs or whatever that was. And I wish I'd focused a little bit more. Now, self-care can mean knowing how to be a great person. We've talked about that a lot. It can also just mean knowing how not to be a bad person. And this applies to being a parent or a partner or a spouse or a caregiver, as well as being an employee. Know when you're not being your best self and how to navigate back to being your best self. And if you're in a meeting and all of a sudden you're realizing that the whole meeting is pivoting around the fact that people are scared of your temper, you know, you better go figure out how to be your better self, because you're actually hurting the company or the group or the team or the people you care deeply about. So self-care is the route to caring about those around you. And so that can mean I need to go read papers. I have a guy who works for me who says if he doesn't read 3 or 4 papers a week, he just feels bad about himself. I have a lady who works for me who says, I go over my week and I determine where time was wasted on my team. And I figure out how to not waste that time next week. And that's her mechanism for self-care, for being like, this is what's important to me. So I think it's going to be different for every human being. But I think what we all need to do is sit back just far enough to figure out what's important to us, and then sit back one step farther and figure out how to put time into that. And that's it. And it could be professional growth or human growth or getting along with your spouse better or coding better. But I think that self-care, if everyone does that, the world just turns into a better place and a company turns into a better place. Now, you have to support that, because at a company, there are times when everyone just has to knuckle down. No, we're not going to fix that tech debt this week. No, we're not going to do that picnic this month because we don't have the money. But I think that there's a long-term balance that we can have at a company where employees at a company can feel like the company cares about them and cares about them caring about themselves.
Interesting. So there's two parts to this. One, you know, the company portion, which I want to address, but also you kind of alluded to the idea that learning as well as professional development is a part of self-care. It's a part of good health. And in terms of the company caring, there's simple things you can do as a company. Now, this is a little more complicated when you're, you know, 3,000 employees, in which case you might have to do it departmentally or team-based. But for example, one of the things that Command Prompt does is we have book exchanges, but the book exchange is random. The only person that actually knows who is matched up with which team member is actually myself in this situation. And what happens is that a person says, Ivan is my book recipient this month. And Ivan doesn't know that it's Debbie that's sending the book, for example.
Well, that's fun.
Yeah. And Command Prompt pays for it, right? We just set a budget and say each person gets X amount of dollars and you send them this book. And then what we do is we have a team time via, via video conference, of course, where people try to guess who sent them the book.
That's fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's kind of like a Secret Santa, but with book. And we've done Secret Santas too, but it's a little more complicated when you have a globally distributed team, because there's certain team members that can't receive shipments and things like that. But that is one of the ways that our company cares, is that we make it a point, even though we're all remote, not always been remote, or since like 04, that we still connect on that human level, so that we're not just bits and bytes or text in an email or a chat window. Now, let's talk about professional development. I mean, I think we both agree that professional development is important, no matter what, not only what stage in life you're in, but also who you are in your career, whether you're an engineer or an office manager or whatever. But I think that recognizing and being willing to listen to those who observe you, what your talents and skills are, I think that is vitally important to your own professional success. And for example, just because you're a brilliant developer doesn't mean you're a great people leader or a manager. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, so I'm still... I'm working on this one. To what degree do you give someone feedback? Do you have to give it to them gentle enough that it doesn't cause, you know, them to go into a hole? You have to give it to them strong enough that they realize it's important. And so I am a total proponent of feedback. But what we are trying to do at MongoDB, just as an example of this, is we're going to start moving to a culture in engineering where we ask managers to never let a piece of feedback go longer than a week. You know, some employees might be a 2-week one-on-one, but longer than your one-on-one. In other words, every time you finish a one-on-one, the employee and the manager both know that the decks are clear. And we're trying to keep feedback so low stakes that nothing builds up. So no one's like afraid of their one-on-one because, hey, last week you could have spent better in that meeting. That's not a big deal. As opposed to for the last 6 months, you've been unproductive in the architecture meetings. That's a big deal. So when I think about getting better, I think about feedback in a way that I can process it. And I know that I and others can process low stakes, regular feedback much easier than high stakes, punctuated feedback. And I'm really working on that with my leadership team right now.
I think that's a good point. So with the way the command prompt is structured, I don't actually interact outside of some very specific projects. I don't actually interact with the engineering team that much anymore. I leave that to our COO, Amanda Nystrom. And to kind of give a credence or credibility to what you just said, if I say to one of the team members, can we have a call? I have firsthand experience that the impact of that is much stronger than if Amanda is saying, hey, let's have our weekly touch base. Let's see where we're at. Here's the feedback. Hey, this slipped through the cracks. Let's pick that up. Because it is weekly. And like you said, it's low stakes and you end up in a scenario where the deck is clear. Whereas if all of a sudden JD wants a call, there's this presumed, which I feel bad about, because 99.99% of the time when I want to have a call, it's because either A, I want to chew the fat about some great idea that you had, or B, I need you to tell me I'm crazy for some idea that I think is great that I had, right? And it's unfortunate, but you know, when the owner wants to talk to you and he doesn't engage on an everyday basis or even every week basis, which I do on purpose because I want the team to succeed without me, there is that certain level of, you know, why does the boss want to talk to me? So I think you're absolutely right that you have to keep it low stakes, and that connection needs to happen in order to allow those types of unfortunate or misunderstood situations to happen.
So the way I deal with that, I'm just gonna interrupt you because I have lived that as an executive of 1,000-person groups multiple times in my career. I have lived that. And the way that I have figured out to diffuse that at least a little bit is when I reach out to someone, you know, Susie, oh my God, it'd be great if we could chat sometime in the next couple of weeks, comma, I have this crazy idea and I think you might be a great person to tell me whether or not it's a good idea. So I never leave them wondering. And I don't say what the idea is, you know, whatever, because that'd be stupid. But I just say, I never leave them wondering, what is the purpose of this meeting? Because the natural human behavior is that when the tiger wants to talk to the deer is going to be nervous. It's just a power dynamic. And there's literally nothing you can do. So rather than trying to pretend the power dynamic isn't there, I've actually just embraced it and said, you know, hey, I'm the CTO and I would just love to have 30 minutes of your time to chat through this idea with me. And it's been something I've done. So I'd advise you to do that too, to always diffuse those situations.
No, I think that is a very well-rounded piece of advice. And I would follow it up with, well, that means that I would actually have to plan the phone calls because I have a tendency to say, can I call you? Right. So that's on me, right? Absolutely on me. But I feel bad because it's like, hey, yeah, you got a minute for a call? And it, you know, they're just like, holy crap, where did he come from? But moving on, let's talk, because we're running low on time here and I want to respect everybody's time, but we've just got a couple more things that we wanted to touch base on. Let's talk about, you know, leadership versus management, being a leader without being a manager. You know, I think it's important because a lot of people don't understand the difference. They think it's the same. And they think that you should have, the leaders should have the same skill set as managers, and managers should be good at this, but leaders are actually really terrible at what this is. So what is the this?
I've been at companies where leadership and management were equated to each other, and at companies where they were different. And just in the spirit of not throwing anyone under the bus, I will say that Amazon and Oracle both do a fantastic job of separating leadership and management.
But and not so, Mongo? You know,
no, Mongo does too, by the way, but I'm just talking about my prior career. I'm talking about my prior career. But the thing is, leadership is about where's the company going? What's the inspiration? Why are we doing this? How will we delight customers? Those things where you talk with this person and you just feel smarter or more excited when you're done talking to him. That's a leader, okay, or her. And management is about, wow, these three teams all depend on each other. And unfortunately, because of history, we share one code base. How are we gonna actually orchestrate the management of that code base? Or, hey, we have an on-call schedule. And look, the reality is we have a lot more tickets coming in than we want right now. Someone has to be on call 24/7. How are we going to manage that so everyone feels that it is equitable? Notice I didn't say equal, equitable. And so those are the differences. And what happens is companies do this very unfortunate thing, which is they will often pay managers more than they will pay ICs at the same level. And so humans are very programmable. And humans will decide, I would like to make more money. And so they will go to being a manager, even though the reality is that if you don't feel the calling for management, that is no different than not feeling the calling for databases or the calling for code or the calling for anything else. And what I mean by the calling for management, there's a book that said this somewhere. And it said, and I know there's people who are going to like gag when they hear this on this podcast, management can be the most noble of professions. In no other role can you help so many people so deeply. That's what being a manager is. Now, being a leader is, I want to change the world of tech or the world of databases or make $1 billion or whatever it is. That's what being a leader is. And when I say it that way, I hope that you and the listeners, I mean, those two things aren't even related to each other.
Well, I would say they're related in one way. They need each other.
Well, yes, they need each other, but you could be one without the other. You could be both. They're very different. And so companies that pay individual contributors and managers of the same level, the same amount, or even pay ICs a little bit more, I'm a fan of. Because I'm telling you right now, and all directors and VPs who work for me, please take this with a grain of salt. It is harder for me to hire a senior principal engineer than it is for me to hire a director. And I'm really focused on the impact that leader ICs can have on an entire company, just as much as I'm focused on the impact that leader managers can have as well.
Well, I think that's a good point. I actually was thinking about this earlier today. And one of the keys here is to remember that one is not necessarily better. It's different.
Yep.
Right. And it, going to your point of equality versus, you know, equitable. But I have a question for you. I'd be curious, knowing you, what your response is to this. What is one of the most important roles, if not the most important role, in a school? And when I say role, I'm not talking about, well, teaching kids. I'm talking about the IC, who is the individual contributor that is likely the most important in a school.
Wow, that's really hard. I don't actually have a great answer to that, dude.
The custodian.
Oh, tell me why.
Without the custodian, everybody gets sick. The teachers get sick. They can't teach the kids. The kids get sick, get other kids sick. Without the custodian, you have, well, I mean, you've been to elementary school. The bathrooms are disgusting. Without the custodian, you have trash piling up everywhere. You have the signs from last week's football game are still up or not put up.
Well, there's a joke about the human body and which organ is most important. And I'm not going to tell the joke, but you can imagine based on what you just said. I'm going to come back at you with something very different. And what I'm going to come back at you at, and I say this regularly, is every employee of this company is equally important. We are putting you in a role that stretches you, hopefully. We are putting you in a role that we are paying you equitably or fairly for doing what you do. And without any one of you, the company can't function. And so I think that there's elitist behavior sometimes about, you know, which people are more important and which people are less important. I think that every person has a role to play in the success of the company. And so for you, the custodians are, you know, equally important to the teacher, to the principal, to the curriculum designer, to the crossing guard that people, you know, depend on to get safely to school.
No, absolutely. That's exactly what I was trying to say. All right, as we wrap up here, you know, one of the things that I think is important with an engineering culture, especially as people adapt and you know, glass half empty versus glass half full, those types of things, is to remember that we are in control of our own behavior. You know, one of the things as a father, and your father as well, that I have always said to my kids is you can't necessarily control how you feel, but you can certainly control how you react to those feelings. It's okay to be upset. It's okay to feel territorial. It's okay to, you know, be hurt or whatever. But you still have to be able to reflect on why you feel those that way and how to make the situation better, as well as not harm, not necessarily physically harm or even emotionally harm, but harm the goal, right? In terms of moving forward. Just because, for example, you don't like a decision that a manager made, doesn't mean that you don't buckle down, pull up the pants and do the best that you can with the decision that was made. And I think that that's important because teams sometimes have this tendency, especially individuals within a team, that, you know, if they're going through a hard time in life or whatever, or even if they just, you know, they were the primary developer for so long and now someone new is coming in and saying all these things about your code that you don't agree with, and therefore you're putting walls up. And instead of putting those walls up, embracing what's happening to you and those feelings so that you understand them, so that you can make better decisions. Does that seem reasonable to you, Mark?
Yeah, it seems totally reasonable. It comes back to what I said about candor earlier. Candor goes, you know, sideways in the org chart, up in the org chart, down in the org chart. You know, in our last podcast, we talked about the tree and the trunk and supporting people. And I think that, you know, I have an executive coach and she's fantastic. And I'm calling you out here, Saba. And one of the things she tells me is that it is the most important thing that you can do to speak what you feel and set an example so that others who are on the other side of a power dynamic learn that they can also speak what they feel. And like you said, feelings should not be judged. Actions, behaviors, those can be judged, but feelings are actually just facts. And so I think that in a well-functioning corporation, which is what we're trying to get to right now, if you can't speak what people are actually feeling, you are fundamentally handicapped in solving it and moving forward. And so, you know, we've gone down this whole talk about healthy cultures. And, you know, I think you and I have both been very direct and very candid with each other. And it's these kind of conversations where we all admit that we feel imposter syndrome every day. We all admit that we're not sure about what that person on the other side of the phone meant when they said it. We all admit that, you know, we're struggling at home this week more than last week or whatever. And we become present by speaking it, I think is one of the most important things we should focus on to have healthy engineering cultures.
I agree completely. And with that, this has been More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it. Thank you to Mark Porter and MongoDB for participating and giving us their time again.
This podcast is hosted by JD, Command Prompt founder and Postgres conference chair, and is produced by me, Lindsay Hooper, Director of Events at Command Prompt, Inc. Command Prompt provides Postgres support, professional services, custom development, and community leadership. Since 1997, we've focused on providing just excellent service, custom tailored to your organization's needs. We'll see you soon, wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be right back.